I'm Tom Hall. This is Midday. Today, another in our series of conversations with the candidates. Congressman Andy Harris has represented Maryland's first congressional district since 2011. His winning election margins ever since have been substantial. Last June, he handily won his primary to run for a fifth term. He's a staunch conservative in a sprawling district that includes all or part of 12 different counties, including the Eastern Shore and parts of Baltimore, Harford, and Carroll counties. The first district is the only one in Maryland that voted for Donald Trump in 2016. This year, Dr. Harris faces a spirited challenge from the Democratic nominee, Jesse Colvin, a former Army Ranger and first-time candidate. Early voting starts a week from today. Congressman Andy Harris joins me when Midday starts right after these headlines. Good afternoon and welcome. It's Midday. I'm Tom Hall. Thanks for being with us today. It's another installment of our series of conversations with the candidates. My guest is Congressman Andy Harris. He represents Maryland's 1st District, which includes the Eastern Shore, plus parts of Baltimore, Harford, and Carroll counties. It's a total of 12 counties that are all or part of the district. Representative Harris is the only Republican in the 8-member Maryland congressional delegation. The 1st District is the only Maryland district that Donald Trump carried in 2016. Andy Harris is a physician and anesthesiologist who practiced at Johns Hopkins Hospital and hospitals on the Eastern Shore. He also served 16 years in the Naval Reserve. He entered politics in 1998 when he was elected to the Maryland State Senate. 10 years later, he defeated moderate Republican Wayne Gilchrist in the 1st District congressional primary. He lost the general election that year to Democrat Frank Cradiville, but in 2010, he ran again and beat Cradiville. He's held the seat ever since. He's running now for his 5th term in Congress. His opponents are the Democratic nominee, former Army Ranger Jesse Colvin, and a Libertarian candidate, Jenica Martin. Dr. Harris is 61 years old. He is the father of 5 children and the grandfather of 7. His wife of 34 years, Cookie, passed away suddenly 4 years ago. He remarried last year. He and his wife, Nicole, live in Cockeysville. We'll take your phone calls a little later in the program. In the meantime, you're welcome to send us an email. You can drop us a tweet at Midday WYPR. You can also ping us on the WYPR Facebook page where we are streaming our conversation. Dr. Harris, it's good to meet you, sir. Thanks for coming in.
Good to be here.
So a lot of folks talk to me about their sort of primary concern with the political climate in general now, being this terrible polarization and partisanship in Washington, D.C. How important is that to you? What's your assessment of the level of partisanship and polarization? How important is it to you as a congressperson to address it?
Sure. You know, there are two levels at which this is an issue. The first one is what I'll call kind of the media level, where all the partisanship is hyped. And then there's the level below where you actually get along with each other and you solve problems. You know, one of the things that I did, and you mentioned my physician background, is there was actually a policy in the United States that if an HIV positive potential organ donor could not donate their organs even to an HIV positive recipient. Made no sense whatsoever. So, you know, we got together, and again, you know, this is not one that's going to be on the front page of any newspaper because it wasn't partisan, but, you know, we got together across the aisle, across the Capitol, with a group of senators, Democrats, Republicans on the House side. I co-sponsored the bill. Actually, I was the main sponsor with one Democrat co-sponsor, and we solved it. We said, no, actually, we're going to change the policy, that actually an HIV-positive person can donate an organ to an HIV-positive person. I mean, that saved hundreds of lives. But that kind of thing never gets reported. What's reported is, you know, when the pitched battles occur, when the Kavanaugh fight occurs, that's what makes news. So, yeah, on the one level, there is this play for the media. But on the other level, we may talk about marijuana later, same thing, where we cross the aisle as a researcher to try to get marijuana research done, good marijuana research on medical marijuana. That's a bipartisan issue. And it's one that is working along in a bipartisan fashion, not going to get the big headlines. So that's my frustration, is that, you know, the headlines are the partisanship, but underneath it, actually, we're getting the job done.
And perhaps this is headline stuff, but you've been associated, for example, with the Freedom Caucus.
Sure.
You're a supporter of President Trump.
Uh-huh.
And people, you know, looked President Trump as one of the most polarizing figures in the history of American politics. These campaign rallies that he continues to do, and the rallies he did even before he was campaigning for anybody, seemed to be targeted towards the people who voted for him. And there didn't seem to be any effort on the president's part to bring in those who did not, to unify the country. As a member of the Freedom Caucus and as a supporter of the Trump policies and by association, perhaps his behavior, how does that position you to cultivate a climate of bipartisanship in the Congress?
Sure. Well, I'll disagree the basis of the question. It in no way associate. I mean, I'm not associated with the president's behavior. I disavow the president's behavior when it's unbecoming. It's painful to watch sometimes, even for me. But I do associate myself with his policies that have brought economic boon, not only to the United States, but to the 1st Congressional District. The House Freedom Caucus really is not, it has nothing to do with Trumpism or anti-Trumpism or pro-Trumpism. I mean, it's a group of conservative Republicans who believe that we need to, restore some conservative principles, especially along fiscal lines.
In that regard, the tax cuts that were passed by Congress last December are going to have a very, very significant impact on deficits.
Well, we got to get the numbers right here. When President Obama issued his stimulus plan, it was a $1.2 trillion hit to the debt and deficit in 1 year. This one, if you assume static, and you understand the difference between the static and dynamic determinations by the Congressional Budget Office, they assume static determination. That is, if you lower taxes, you lower revenue. But the fact is, last month we had the highest revenue ever in the United States come into the United States government. That's because the CBO didn't take into account the fact that we have now pushed economic growth in the United States to 4.2%, unemployment down. When unemployment goes down, two things positively affect revenue. You have fewer people on government help programs. You can call them welfare programs, whatever you want. And these people, instead of being on the negative side of the ledger, are now actually having a job paying payroll taxes and income taxes. So the problem was the CBO assumed static economic conditions. I think that's not the right way to do it.
So when the CBO, for example, estimates that we'll have deficits of more than $1.9 trillion over the next decade, you don't accept that estimate?
In the next sentence, they say, and we assume, and I don't know exactly what their GDP growth figures were, but they weren't 4% growth. So yeah,
you're also assuming that we can sustain 4% growth, not just for a quarter or
not,
two,
not 4%,
but for years and years at a time.
The CBO had said before President Trump took office that GDP growth was likely to be, the economic advisors said GDP growth is likely to average 2%. That's it, 2%. Well, if you think that that's all this country is capable of doing, then their estimates are probably right in terms of the debt and deficit. I don't think that's true, and I think President Trump proved it. He cut regulations, we cut taxes, we got growth to 4.2, and now the estimate is that it will be maintained at above 4% for 2018 and 2019 at least. Now, it doesn't last forever.
Quarter after quarter after quarter.
That those are the estimates now. They're not my estimates. They're the economic advisor's estimates that it's now going to be sustained until at least the end of 2019.
But there are also estimates that the debt service, because we're borrowing so much more, $1 trillion annually, the debt service in just a matter of a couple of years will exceed the what we pay for Medicaid. It'll exceed what we pay for the entire military budget by 2023. And by 2024, it will exceed what we pay for Medicare. I mean, just paying off our debt is going to cost so much money.
Here's what my observations are. And I've been, again, as you said, going for my fifth term in Congress. We have only three choices in how to solve the debt and deficit the problem long term. We can cut spending, and there's no appetite for that at all on Capitol Hill. I wish there were. I voted for Republican budgets that actually would have Republican alternate budgets, Republican study committee budgets that would have actually balanced the budget over 10 years and then begun to pay down the debt. There's no appetite for cutting spending. You could increase taxes. I get very few phone calls from constituents saying, you know what, my taxes aren't high enough. Well, bump them up a little bit more. or we can stimulate the economy and attempt to grow our way out of this. I think the third choice is the only one that's actually politically feasible, because there is no, I wish there were more people who are willing to cut spending. That's why I don't vote for debt ceiling increases unless they are coupled with something that will control our rate of spending growth. And recently, that's what Mr. Boehner did years ago. Recently, they haven't been doing that with the debt ceiling increase, and that's why I don't vote for debt ceiling increase anymore.
Let me give you a fourth option, which is to reallocate tax revenue to have the corporations, for example, and have wealthy individuals pay a little bit more so that there is, in fact, more tax revenue. CNN reports that people, shareholders of companies and people in the upper incomes are going to see a windfall of $171 billion from this last bill, whereas about $6 billion goes into the pockets of the so-called working middle class. I mean, the corporate tax rate was 35% before the bill. It's now down to 21, right? So I think even Democrats agreed that 35% was too high as a corporate tax rate, right? But from it going to 35 to 21, if I'm remembering correctly, but why not 23 or 24? Because those extra 2 or 3 points could produce an awful lot of money to be able to sustain the kinds of programs that that people have come to rely on.
Sure. I think you have to check your figures. The return to the middle-class taxpayers is way more than $6 billion, regardless. The problem is, and I tell people this all the time, I remember about 10 years ago, I'm an anesthesiologist, we work in the operating room. I remember opening up what's called an endotracheal tube, which is what the plastic tube we put down through your mouth into your windpipe so we can breathe for you during an operation. And I remember opening up and seeing on the cover that it said, made in Ireland. And literally at the time I'm thinking, why is this made in Ireland? I mean, of all the places in the world, you know, why not Germany where, you know, the German precision manufacturing, or why not the United States where we make plastic stuff? Why not over some other place? And then when I went to Congress and we got educated about what our corporate tax rate is and the corporate tax structure in the United States, that's when I found out, yeah, Ireland has a corporate tax rate of 13. We have one of 35. If you were going to make something and make a profit, where would you do it? You'd do it in Ireland. So we didn't come down. I mean, when we thought about how far to lower the corporate tax rate, we didn't come down to Ireland. We came down to a point where we think we're going to attract companies back into the United States. We're going to stop companies from leaving, start attracting companies back to the United States. I think we hit the sweet spot. Now, that being said, we could attempt to increase the corporate tax rate again and hope that somehow that magically increases revenues. But I think it's unrealistic in a global economy to think that by raising a rate that makes us less competitive in the global economy, we're actually going to improve our economy. This is a disagreement. I mean, I think that if we want to stimulate our economy, we have to make our businesses. And the other thing is, who are the shareholders of large corporations? They're pension funds in general. I mean, most of the shares owned by large are pension funds. Pension funds are for us Americans. So when we make the bogeymen, a company like ExxonMobil, and this would all the time, you know, people, you know, marching around ExxonMobil, yeah, you do terrible things. This is one of the largest oil companies in the world, and it's actually headquartered in the United States. Why would we want to drive it out of the United States? Why would we want to make our corporate climate unfavorable to one of the largest companies in the world in a sector that's very important for not only economically, but geopolitically.
Sure. And of course, not to get too deep in the weeds here, but there are those who said that even when it was a 35% corporate tax rate, the actual rate, the realistic rate that companies are paying, because the corporate tax rate doesn't exist in a vacuum, was something like 18%. So, but leaving that aside, just 2 days ago, because you mentioned that there's no appetite for cutting programs and cutting spending in Congress now. Just 2 days ago on Bloomberg TV, Mitch McConnell said that we need to look at reining in entitlement programs, Medicare, Medicaid, and Social Security, because it by his estimate, takes up 70% of the budget. This isn't something that we heard a lot about during the discussion of the tax cuts last year, but it's now something that Paul Ryan has mentioned that. Now Mitch McConnell, these are the two leaders in Congress. Should we expect a conversation about cutting Medicare and Social Security in the near future?
Well, we certainly have to deal with the Medicaid expansion. There's no question, because it's the most most of the three you mentioned, it's the most rapidly increasing segment of those three. Social Security is on a pretty good glide path right now. I mean, Medicare expenditures continue to rise. That's of concern because the Affordable Care Act did not rein in Medicare expenditures. They continue to rise. We have to deal with the increase in Medicare expenditures while we preserve Medicare for anyone who's in or near retirement as we know it. Medicaid is a different situation because Medicaid is you know, this hybrid program where the federal government pays. It varies. In Maryland, they pay about 57% of traditional Medicaid. They pay about 92% of the additional Medicaid individuals who were enrolled under the Affordable Care Act. And for the first time, these are, for instance, able-bodied adults. So in the past, it's been for the elderly, the sick, the disabled, pregnant women. Now, under the Affordable Care Act, it rolls in able-bodied adults. Now, we think there are two things that should be done. First of all the government studies have shown there's about a 15% fraud rate in Medicaid because you either have people who aren't eligible on the rolls and other elements of fraud, health providers who know how to game the system and are fraudulently billing, things like that. So we think there's about 15%, and this is backed up by the government studies. So we think that since it's a joint federal-state issue with the state actually administering the program, we have to provide an incentive to the state to cut the fraud out of the system. That's one thing. The second thing is
states aren't automatically incentivized to cut fraud. What state would want to have fraud?
Well, let me ask you, if the federal government was paying 90% of the cost of those additional people under the ACA, why wouldn't you want to bring 90% of that dollar into the state if the state's only paying 10%? Think about the return on investment. Why cut fraud in that group? Because you're bringing in 90 cents of the dollar.
Because fraud is the wrong thing to allow.
Well, let me tell you something. Then you got to tell me, why is there a 15% rate? But there is. And it can't be, we can't track it out of Washington because the program is administered locally. So we think that what you do is you turn the money over to the states and say, look, here's the chunk of money you get. And we're gonna take it and we're going to inflate it over time. So every year you get a little more. And you deal, and if you want to expand Medicaid coverage in your state, you want to expand what it covers, go ahead, save some money on decreasing fraud and spend that extra money on helping more people or helping the same number of people to a greater extent. I think that's a perfectly reasonable way to proceed. It's exactly what they did in the American Health Care Act. We said we're going to block grant to the states and we're going to allow the states to have a stake in this. And the states that have done this, who have done this kind of mechanism, actually have been able to save money, turn it around, and provide more. The other thing is for the able-bodied adults, again, I'm not talking about the elderly, the disabled, women with children. We think that in return for getting Medicaid assistance, you should agree to get a job or train for a job or even volunteer for something. We think that asking someone to do something like that in return, again, able-bodied adults, without dependents, we think that that's a reasonable thing to do. And so those, both of them could control the cost of Medicaid. Again, if we have the able-bodied adult getting a job and becoming employed, sooner or later, they don't need the Medicaid coverage. So it actually saves Medicaid dollars, makes them a revenue-paying taxpayer.
Right, and we'll take that up when we come back from a break. We'll talk lots more about health care. Congressman Andy Harris is my guest for the hour. He's running for re-election in the 1st Congressional District. His opponent is the Democratic nominee, Jesse Coleman. We'll try to take some of your calls, your emails, and tweets when we come back. 410-662-8780, our email, midday@wypr.org, our Twitter handle, @MiddayWYPR. If you want to follow me on Twitter, @TomHallWYPR, and we are streaming on the WYPR Facebook page. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
This is Your Public Radio, 88.1 WYPR.
Welcome back. It's Midday. I'm Tom Hall. By the way, coming up tomorrow, Dr. Miho Tanaka, the director of the Women's Sports Medicine Program at Johns Hopkins Hospital, will join me with tips for staying injury-free while exercising. The Baltimore Running Festival is on Saturday, and Dr. Tanaka will answer your questions about what to do before, during, and after the race, or anytime that you're doing your bit to stay fit. That's coming up tomorrow
On Midday, if you've just joined us today, my guest is Congressman Andy Harris. He's running for re-election in Maryland's 1st Congressional District against the Democratic nominee, Jesse Colvin. You can join us here on Midday at 410-662-8780. Our email, midday@wypr.org. Our Twitter handle, @MiddayWYPR. And we are streaming on the WYPR Facebook page. So talking about health care, there are roughly 55,000 people in your district who rely on the ACA.
Yep.
You consistently voted to repeal the ACA for several years, many, many votes. What are the elements of the ACA that you think should be retained? What do you think should be punted? You did vote for the AHCA, yep, which is the bill you alluded to when we were talking about this earlier. But, you know, when it comes to pre-existing conditions or being able to insure your kids up until age 26, these are things that are very popular. How should we, if we're going to continue to try to fix the ACA, is it a matter of punting the whole thing and starting over, which it seems to be indicated you were for when you voted to repeal it earlier on? What should we be doing?
Well, first of all, you know, one of the things that gets spread around is somehow I voted 70 times to repeal the ACA. That's crazy. I think there are actually two votes to repeal the bill. One the very first time we got elected, which is what I would call, you know, kind of a show vote. We knew it wasn't going anywhere in the Senate, that we were going to have a replacement, and we had replacements planned. But that
certainly wasn't clear to people. People didn't think that the Republicans had a plan in place.
We did. We had plans all along the way. And I know because I was on the Republican Study Committee, I helped draft some of them. So the fact is that there were only a couple of votes that were just outright repeal votes. The rest, actually, of that 70, I think 8 or so were repeals of some little areas that President Obama actually signed. So I'm going to assume that that's actually okay. That's all aside. Here's what we got to do. We have to make sure. What the Affordable Care Act didn't do is, if you're not getting a government subsidy, this didn't work for you. And we already talked about the Medicaid expansion. I think the able-bodied adults actually should be asked to have a job or job training. So we're going to put the Medicaid population aside. You're left with the people who are on the exchanges. There are two groups: people who get the subsidy, whose incomes are low enough that they can't afford to pay the entire cost of the premiums, which, of course, as we know in Maryland, have roughly over doubled since the ACA policies were begun to be sold 4 years ago, or the people who pay for the entire cost themselves. These are priced completely out of the average person. If they're on the cusp of not being able to get that subsidy, these are unaffordable policies.
So, and were they better off before the ACA?
Let me tell you why.
Was it cheaper?
In Maryland, absolutely. In Maryland, we dealt, and right up front, I've always supported coverage for pre-existing conditions. I still support it. It was in the ACA, the American Healthcare Act, with our substitute bill. But what we think, and as a policy person, I have a master's degree in health policy from Bloomberg School, but from a policy point of view, the problem is covering people who have medical problems, because we know that the sickest 10% of people spend about 80% of the healthcare dollar. So the question is, how do you cover them and spread the risk wide enough that the premiums for everyone else aren't too high? And the key is, and I kind of gave it away, you have to spread the risk wide enough. In Maryland, that's exactly what we did before the ACA came into play. So, for instance, if you had a medical condition and you were, quote, uninsurable, that is, at first, and I know I was in the Senate when we passed the program and promoted the program, it's called the Maryland Health Insurance Program. If you had a disease and two companies rejected you, you'd go to the Maryland Health Insurance Plan and get a subsidized plan that cost about 10 to 30% more than every year the legislature voted on what that increment was. So given the political climate, depended on exactly how much it was priced above a low-risk person, and you had a plan that was actually administered by Blue Cross Blue Shield, it was actually a good insurance plan, it did cost about 10 to 30% more than the low-risk person did. But the beauty of it was it spread the cost of covering that subsidy among everyone in Maryland by a very small tax on every hospitalization. And obviously, every hospitalization is paid for by every insurer in
but
Maryland.
Isn't the best way to spread the risk is to increase the pool? So the individual mandate says, we'll give these insurance companies all these extra patients, all those extra premiums, and then they will use those premiums to care for the most sick as well as the people who are in pretty good health right now.
But Tom, the ultimate pool is all of us. because they have it for the grace of God, all of us could be there. That was the failing. It actually restricted the subsidy and the pooling into only the individual marketplace. If you were buying a policy on the individual market, that was the restricted pool. So what they did is you had some states that did some very clever things. So Maine, for instance, the blind high-risk pool. Maryland had a high-risk pool. I congratulate the legislature for the solution they came up with this year, which are reinsurance programs. These reinsurance programs spread the risk among
this
the
is a
entire
state
population.
Program, right?
Correct.
Mm-hmm.
But it's exactly what we would have allowed in the American Health Care Act.
But in the American Health Care Act, and again, you're the expert on health policy, sir, not me. But I've talked to reporters like Elizabeth Rosenthal, who used to write about healthcare for the New York Times. She's now with Kaiser Health News, Julie Rovner. They say that there's really no evidence that these high-risk pools are cost-effective or even efficacious in a medical sense, that they just don't work.
In Maryland, they were, again, the premiums on the individual marketplace more than doubled. So, and people have said, well, my gosh, if we go back to a high-risk pool and we would charge someone 10 to 30% above the low-risk cost, I'm like, okay, we're now charging them twice as much, more than twice as much, because the mechanism for spreading the risk was not adequate in the Affordable Care Act. And again, it's really a very serious policy point, but one that a lot of people don't understand how you have to spread the risk as wide as possible.
And CBO,
and Maryland solved the problem.
Okay, and we need to get on to some other issues. Sure. But CBO also estimated, this Congressional Budget Office, that under the Republican plan that you voted for, that Congress passed, that stalled in the Senate, so nothing happened. That was the famous vote that John McCain cast to kill that, would have insured 24 to 27 million fewer people.
They assume that 24 to 27 million fewer people would not choose to, because we did, now don't get me wrong, we removed the individual mandate. We did not tell any American that you have to buy a government-sponsored program. And they assume that if you don't make someone do it, they're actually going to make an economic decision to not buy it. They also assumed that if you put in, for instance, work requirements in Medicaid, there will be people who will say, I'd rather not have my Medicaid than work for a living, even though I'm able-bodied. Those are voluntary choices of people who choose not to avail themselves of insurance that's available. And we think by bringing the cost down, it makes it more likely that someone actually would take it.
All right, let's go on to some other issues. My guest is Congressman Andy Harris. Our number here at Midday, 410-662-8780. Our email, midday@wypr.org. Our Twitter handle, @MiddayWYPR. And we are streaming on the WYPR Facebook page. Let's go to Josh in Churchville. Josh, welcome to Midday with Congressman Harris.
Hi, Doctor. I'm a fan of what you have done in your past four terms, and I will be voting for you for your fifth term. However, I do think that Mr. Colvin has struck a chord with watermen and environmentalists, and I was wondering, what have you done for watermen and for the bay?
Sure, that's a great question. Let me talk to you about two things that I've done where I've actually taken leadership positions in Washington. The first is, and let's deal with the bay first. We'll deal with watermen in a second. In terms of the bay, it's very interesting. As Tom mentioned, I support President Trump generally, because when his budget came out and said he was, I think the first year he's actually going to zero out the Chesapeake Bay program. I think the second year he was going to cut it by 80% or something. I opposed it. I signed letters to the committees. I actually sit on the
Appropriations
Committee.
Offshore drilling you originally supported and then changed your mind on that, I guess?
No. Offshore drilling, no, my position's always been the same on offshore drilling, Tom. It's if the local jurisdiction doesn't agree to it, then I oppose it. So I oppose offshore drilling off the coast of Maryland. I'm not going to talk about other states. If other states want to pursue it, they feel it's safe, God bless them. Off the shore of Maryland, I have never supported it, and I've always opposed it. Again, but let me talk specifically about the Chesapeake Bay program. So I supported fully funding. It's actually been fully funded the last 2 years. This is the most important program. It's delivered by the EPA because our pollution in Maryland, in our Maryland waters of the bay, does not come from Maryland. It comes from Pennsylvania and it comes from New York. Those polluters there will not be controlled unless, and I say polluters, but I mean, you know, it's farm runoffs, things like that, unless we have a program that's an interstate program. They're never going to agree to an interstate compact and say, voluntarily, we're going to tell our farmers not to do something because they don't see the repercussions of the pollution. Maryland sees the repercussions. So the Chesapeake Bay program is important. It's an interstate. It's where the federal government plays a correct role of an interstate arbiter, where without an interstate arbiter, there is no incentive for New York and Pennsylvania to comply in any way with pollution control. So I fully support the program. And actually, your readers in Churchville, if they get the Star Democrat, you know, I mean, look, I got praised in the Star Democrat by the Chesapeake Bay Foundation, thanking me for my support of the Chesapeake Bay program, because they know that's the most important thing to the Bay. Let's talk about the watermen specifically. One of the biggest concerns of the watermen this year was the fact that the seafood processing plants, the crab pickers, did not have enough labor. And this is a problem that Congress has not been willing to deal with over the years. This is, you know, the president just enforces what Congress tells them.
So you were able to expand somewhat the H-2B visa.
Absolutely. When Barbara Mikulski...
How many of them actually came to Maryland? 15,000 were expanded for countrywide. How many
It was proportionate. I mean, I don't know the exact amount. It was proportionate. And we know that Aubrey Vincent at Lindy's Seafood, who, if you see my ads, you see Aubrey... She got some of the expanded amounts. It solved her problem for the end of the season, so that her business could continue. But when Barbara Mikulski was senator, it's very interesting. She was over in the Appropriations Committee in the Senate. I was in the House. We got together. We put the language in the bill. We made sure the language solved the problem every year. Barbara Mikulski leaves. Nobody picks up the slack in the Senate. This is disappointing to me, but I went ahead in the House. The language that's in the bill in our current bill that will go as part of the omnibus bill, now it's going to be negotiated, the language may be changed. Language I put in solves this problem. I'm the leader. It's a bipartisan effort. And here's another bipartisan effort. Again, everybody talks about my co-sponsor is Henry Cuellar from Texas, a Democrat. Because we know this is an issue that, you know, those crabs don't know if it's a Republican or Democrat, you know, on that trot line or pulling up that pot.
But when it comes to the environment, I have an email from a listener, and I'm not in the habit of believing the last thing I'm told, so I haven't had a chance to fact check this myself. But he says that the League of Conservation Voters has rated you at 3%, and you are on record as expressing some doubt as to whether or not human activity and carbon dioxide emissions are a major cause of climate change.
So which part of that last sentence do you want me to comment on?
All of believe the science on climate change?
The humans definitely emit greenhouse gas. There's no question about it. I mean, my gosh, you can't deny that. We actually increase emissions of both methane, which is naturally occurring emissions as well, carbon dioxide, no question about it. The question on climate change boils down to how great is the human effect in terms of what it's doing? Are there other things? Is there sunspot activity, other things going on? And what is the economic cost of choosing to curtail CO2 production in our economy versus mitigation of what we think may happen? And those are, I mean, they're two logical options. Now, we don't know what the absolute effect is going to be because these are all postulates. And, you know, the IPCC projection actually, which was made, a decade and a half ago, you know, it was not accurate. It's actually a little lower our temperature rise than was projected. So these are all models. I mean, you know.
You've heard the estimates, though, that 90% of the scientists who study climate change think that human behavior is a major factor in the problems.
What's major?
Having.
I don't know what's major. And these scientists.
But in other words, you just don't accept that.
No, it's definitely a factor. No question about it. The question is what it would cost to either alleviate CO2 production, which the U.S. can't do on its own. You know, the largest CO2 production
eventually. Should we have pulled out of the Paris Accord?
Because it wasn't strong enough. I mean, the bottom line is the U.S. was going to subsidize third world countries who were going to continue to produce CO2 in an uncontrolled fashion. Tom, I believe the answer to this, and I ask people all the time, well, Tom, do you think we're going to burn gasoline in cars in 50 years? What do you think?
No.
Okay. We got to get to that point. How are we going to get to that point? It's through research. So I actually chaired the Energy and Environment Subcommittee on Science in my first term, which is a little unusual to have a freshman chair, but I have a science background. We actually looked into how we are going to get to that point where we don't burn fossil fuels, and the answer is it's through research. And so that's why I always supported National Science Foundation research. ARPA-E, a great program over in the Department of Energy. It stands for Advanced Research Project Administration for Energy, modeled off ARPA-D, which was a Defense Advanced Research Agency, to get cutting-edge research done, to literally answer the question, how do we get away from fossil fuels? That's the solution in the United States, to promote our research. That's why, whether it's scientific research, it's medical research, I promote research.
But in the meantime,
I think it's the answer.
But in the meantime,
but in the meantime, the question is, do we hurt our economy in order to do that, a relative vis-a-vis other economies in the country? And I also say, Tom, that we have the ability to even consider those decisions because our economy's good. Those countries in the world, and I'll say India because there's a lot of people, their curve of CO2 production is accelerating. They don't have that luxury because their economy can't support it.
Congressman Andy Harris is my guest for the hour. He represents the 1st District, which includes parts of Baltimore, Harford, and Carroll counties, as well as all of the Eastern Shore of Maryland. This is part of our Conversations with the Candidates series. The entire series is available on our website, wypr.org/midday, or by subscribing to our podcast. By the way, coming up Monday, our series continues with former Delegate Johnny Olszewski Jr. and Maryland Insurance Commissioner Al Redmer. They are running against each other for Baltimore County Executive. A televised debate between those two candidates will air on MyTV this Saturday at 4 o'clock, and they will both join me here in Studio A on Midday Monday. I'm Tom Hall. Stay with us.
This is Your Public Radio, 88.1 WYPR.
And welcome back. It's Midday. I'm Tom Hall. If you've just joined us, my guest is Congressman Andy Harris. He is the Republican incumbent in the House of Representatives in the 1st Congressional District. It is a sprawling district, which includes the Eastern Shore all the way up to parts of Harford County. Our phone number, 410-662-8780. Our email, midday@wypr.org. You can drop us a tweet. You can also catch us on Facebook Live. So, Congressman, we got a bunch of people waiting on the phone and got some emails to share with you. Let's go, please, to David in Washington County. David, I guess you want to talk about immigration.
Hi, yes. I have a question. What have you and the Republicans done to restore American sovereignty? Just a quick reminder that 75 years ago, the 7th Infantry Division went up to Attu in Alaska to drive out 2,500 Japanese soldiers, and they lost over 500 men killed doing it. And today, we have between 12 and a latest study from Yale said 20 million undocumented people in America, and I don't think we have sovereignty if we can't determine who's allowed to be in our country.
All right, thanks for the call, David.
Sure.
You mentioned the H-2B visas for, you know, work visas for folks, but
right.
What should comprehensive immigration reform look like?
Sure. And of course, H-2B is not immigration, it's temporary workers, and
right.
So everybody gets that right up front. As the son of immigrants, I realize how important immigrants are to this country. But we have to have a rule of law on immigration. So your question is right on point. How do we bring the law into conformance with what we need in the country and what our immigration is allowed to do? So comprehensive immigration reform has to deal with two things. It has to deal going forward, what do we do? And then looking back, what do we do? So what do we do with people who are here? I have said, for instance, for Dreamers, I've said I have no problem. And actually, we had agreed to it as part of what the immigration reform should have looked like. Even in the Freedom Caucus, said, "Look, we think there's no problem." The question there is,
so there should be a path to citizenship for DACA recipients.
That's not quite what I said. What you have to do is you have to give legal the ability to have legal presence. As long as you are conforming with our law, you're not a criminal, you don't do bad things, you can have continuing legal presence, which is what the DACA program was. The DACA program did not have a path to citizenship. President Obama's DACA program was just ongoing continual legal presence as long as you keep your nose clean. That's reasonable. The real discussion is, what about a pathway to citizenship? And my problem is, and again, we don't want to deny anyone here on the DACA program the ability to become a citizen through means that already exist. And there are many means that exist for people to become citizens. The question is whether you put them at the head of the line, ahead of people who have been waiting 10 or 20 years to come in legally. And I still have a problem saying we should put them to the head of the line. Yes, we should allow them all the ways anyone here illegally can become a citizen. My problem is creating a special pathway. Now, we actually even, and we could get into the weeds of it, we actually said, well, you know, we could combine this with, because the other thing is the temporary protected status. That's the other class of individual who we have to deal with, and we have to deal with by next September, because that's when the TPS program ends for a large number of people. And I think we should look similarly to that group. I mean, that's a group not frequently talked about, we should look similarly to. So we have to be careful providing a special pathway to citizenship for anyone who is not here legally.
But some people are proposing 10 or 12 years from now, these children who were brought over here as little kids who had nothing to do with the decision
to come. Well, or 17-year-olds. I mean, it's not, they're not all babies who come over here.
But there are plenty of babies.
We've been at the border. There are also MS-13 members. So let's not think they're all babies in arms. Some of them actually are 15, 16, 17-year-olds who cross our border specifically to join gangs. And this is not a uniform population.
We hear this from Mr. Sessions. We hear this from Mr. Trump all the time. And I don't hear this from anybody who studies immigration as to the fact that that is some sort of major problem.
It's not major. MS-13 is a major problem. I mean, in Montgomery County.
But that
MS-13
members are not coming over through the DACA program. I don't hear that from anybody who studies this.
Well, there is no DACA program, of course, right? The DACA program is merely something that says if you came here before the age of 18, before you would be legally bound to have made that decision on your own, age of majority, then you are eligible for this program that allows you to continue temporary status.
Do you support Mr. Trump's assertion that we should build a wall?
There are certainly areas along the border where we need a wall. I sit on the Department of Homeland Security.
Does it matter that Mexico's not going to pay for it?
Look, I don't care who the heck pays for it. Our Customs and Border Patrol come before my subcommittee and testified pretty convincingly. There are areas where there is very good evidence that building a wall makes sense. Now, it's not along the entire border. Don't get me wrong, not along the entire border. But on the other hand, what the Democrats did in Congress last year is put language in our appropriations bill that, and this is strange language, that says you got money for a wall, $1.6 billion, but you can't spend any of it on any new wall. So even if Customs and Border Patrol says, you know, there's a segment over there where we're watching drugs come across all the time, we know that a wall can make a difference, their hands are tied by the Democrats in Congress. And I'm like, oh, I'm sorry, I just don't see that. I just don't see the logic in that. We can discuss how much to spend on it, but in the end, I want Customs and Border Patrol to say, where does that wall make
a
difference?
I just wonder if everybody voted on it because they thought Mexico was going to pay for it. That just seemed, that was the promise at the time. So
I don't agree with everything Mr. Trump does
or says.
We have another tweets.
We have another immigration question from Farouk in Baltimore. Welcome to the program with Congressman Harris.
Yeah. Good afternoon, Congressman.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon and assalamu alaikum. I'm a Muslim, you know, and I'm listening all the time this radio. The problem I have, and this hurt me one time, I heard that you were in some public speech and talk about bad about Muslim. I don't know what the Muslim did wrong, in especially in Maryland and throughout America.
All right, Farouk, we'll pose that question to the Congress. Do you support the Muslim ban of Mr. Trump and his efforts to restrict immigration from certain countries?
No, but I did support his idea of saying that there are certain countries where there are radical Islamic forces that might try to come into the United States through those countries, and you have to vet those individuals to a greater degree.
Is Saudi Arabia one of them? They're in the news.
I got to tell you. I might put Saudi Arabia on that list. Pretty clearly, 9/11 had Saudi Arabia connections.
When it comes to Mr. Trump's foreign policy, for example, in these last 48 hours, he seems to be very reluctant to be critical of the Saudi government for what appears to be an abduction and murder of a journalist who lived in Virginia.
Look, the truth has got to come out. And when the truth comes out, if the Saudi government is involved, the president will take a hard position. The president has no problem taking hard positions against people. You can ask Mr. Assad. You can ask the president of North Korea. You can ask Mr. Putin in terms of the sanctions placed against him.
But there's the nothing in the last few days that have indicated any hardness of position against Saudi Arabia. He seems to be more concerned with the money that Saudi Arabia is spending in the United States, and perhaps concerned with the money that they're spending on him personally.
Yeah, Tom, I don't do the 24-hour news cycle deal. You know, I mean, the bottom line is this is foreign policy. It would be foolish for the president to have taken a knee-jerk response. He sent over Mike Pompeo. I know Mike from when he was in the House. Mike is a superb, you know Mike's background, I mean, in the Army. I mean, Mike is a superb person to hold that position. Mike is no fool, not going to be fooled by anybody. Let's just wait to see once all the evidence is in. I think that's what has to happen, and then only judge the president once we know exactly what happened.
We have an email from Jonathan who says, Mr. Harris makes the argument that we don't fully understand the impact of or efficacy of curbing CO2. He ultimately does not believe that we will survive or succeed. It's a cynical logic. Why would you waste public money on trying to save the public good? That's his interpretation of your position.
I'm not sure of his point. I think my position is pretty clear. We have to gauge the economic cost, and we have to go full forward on research into the next gen. And I don't care whether it's fission, it's hydrogen cells. We are not going to burn gasoline 50 years from now. Getting from here to there is only a matter of how determined we are to get from here to there.
Got another question from Crystal in Cecil County about health care costs. And Congressman, this is an issue that's clearly a hot topic with people in your district. You've had some very boisterous town hall meetings about it. Crystal, welcome to the program. We just have a couple minutes left. If you could ask your question quickly, I'd be grateful.
Great. Thank you for having me.
Sure. What's your question?
Costs have been skyrocketing, and expanding and subsidizing insurance does not fix this root problem. Our current methods are not addressing this problem. They're not addressing costs. What new ideas will you introduce in the next 2 years to make healthcare more affordable?
Sure. Great question, Crystal. You know, we treat healthcare differently than we treat everything else we buy. Everything else we buy has absolute price transparency on it. If I ask you, Tom, you know, what you paid for the jacket you're wearing, assuming you didn't buy it many years ago and forgot, you would know exactly what you paid for it because you actually had to put that credit card in, sign a check, give cash, whatever.
It wasn't a lot.
When I would do town hall meetings and I would ask people, you know, how many people, and I'd literally ask it this way, how many people had an MRI? You know, nowadays, Tom, like 3/4 of the hands go up. How many of you know exactly what that MRI costs? Nobody knows. Why?
So transparency in charges is part of it?
Transparency is huge. But that's why I applaud the president saying, we need to make the drug companies put down the cost of the medication in their ads.
Should Medicare and Medicaid be able to negotiate prices for drugs?
Look, through Medicare, they already do. The third party groups, the drug intermediaries, already negotiate for these, and actually they get better bargaining power because they combine their Medicare. For instance, when United sells a healthcare policy to Medicare, it also sells it to about 30 or 40 million people off Medicare. They negotiate for the whole thing. Negotiation is not the issue. We need price transparency, and we need those middlemen in the drug industry to become very transparent in what monies they're making, what monies they're getting from the manufacturers, not transmitting back to the patients.
All right, Congressman, that's all the time we have. I appreciate your time. It does indeed. I appreciate your time, and thanks so much.
Absolutely.
Representative Andy Harris, he's the Republican nominee for Congress in Maryland's 1st District. It includes all of the Eastern Shore and parts of Baltimore, Carroll, and Harford counties. We've got a link to the Andy Harris campaign website at WIPR.org/midday. Our series of conversations with the candidates continues Monday with John Olszewski Jr. and Al Redmer. They'll join me here in Studio A to talk about the important issues in the race for Baltimore County Executive. Election Day is Tuesday, November 6th. That's in about 3 weeks. Early voting begins a week from today. If you are not yet registered, you may register and vote on the same day if you vote early. You are not allowed to register and vote on Election Day, although there is a referendum on the ballot that would allow that in the future. So that's it for us today. Coming up tomorrow, my guest will be Dr. Miho Tanaka with a little segment we call What Hurts Today. She's an internationally acclaimed orthopedic surgeon and the director of the Women's Sports Medicine Program at Johns Hopkins Hospital. She'll take your questions about tips for staying injury-free while exercising, and we'll give a big shout-out to all the folks running in the Baltimore Running Festival, which starts on Saturday. Dr. Tanaka will be here tomorrow on Midday. Lunch today was provided by Eddie's of Roland Park, Baltimore's gourmet grocer since 1944. Eddie's of Roland Park offers a selection of local gift baskets and Maryland jumbo lump crab cakes that can be shipped anywhere throughout the United States. Details online at eddiesofrolandpark.com. www.tomhallshow.com. Thanks again for listening. I'm Tom Hall. Have a great day.